form, balance, and dirt. We talk with a lifelong devotee to the versatility of clay. Coming up. Hello, I am Stephen DeLuque, and along with Krissa Hewitt, producer and host of this program, Ears on Art, a segment of issues and ideas produced here at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving California's Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Today, Krissa and I have the honor of talking with Barry Franz, one of the trio of instructors who created and nurtured the art department curriculum at Cuesta College. Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, constructed the exemplary art department out at Cuesta College seemingly out of thin air. The trio transformed derelict Camp San Luis Obispo buildings into an exciting and inspiring environment for the students. The Cuesta College Art Gallery is honoring the three founding fathers with individual art shows, but more about that later. Here's Barry to share his story.
Stephen and I are here in the studio with Barry Franz. Good afternoon.
Hi, Krissa. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, all.
Barry, your career at Cuesta has been a very long one, and you've been gone from there for a while, I believe. But before we get into that, your career as an artist, when did all that start?
Well, I was always the best one with the paper and the scissors in kindergarten and church school. So, it's from the beginning. Explored other things like natural history and forestry, biology. I ended up back in art because that's just what I was supposed to do, I guess. And it's been a fortunate career. It wasn't the most intelligent solution, but it worked, and I'm extremely fortunate.
Okay, I'm curious, what sorts of things were you making out of cut-up paper?
Well, I've been all my life interested in Native American crafts, and I don't know how many of those are made out of paper, but I sure made a lot of things out of sticks and feathers and made bows and arrows and primitive weapons, and I practiced on my dear sister. As she'd run out the door, I'd flop her in the back with a blunt arrow or something. I spent a lot of time down on the river. I was a sort of a Huckleberry Finn kind of guy until I finished high school and went to college and started getting some serious academics. And then I became a Europhile, interested in all the literature and art, all the avant-garde stuff that was happening over there. Plus the beat movement in San Francisco was happening. So that intrigued me. I was always curious about alternative ways of looking. Growing up in a tiny, tiny Central Valley town, there wasn't much going on there that could sustain my curiosity. My dear grandmother always subscribed to the National Geographic magazine, through which I explore the rest of the world. And then as soon as I finished junior college, preparing for traveling abroad, I studied Spanish and English and German and French. Grabbed a bus and took off when I was 20 and spent a year thumbing around in Europe. Ending up finding a job as a ceramic apprentice in Bavaria, which was wonderful. But boy, they work you all hard. And I thought, you know, I probably need to get back to the States and get into a real program. And so that's what I did. But along the way, I picked up my wife, Barbara, German. We met hitchhiking and hanging out in youth hostels. So I brought her back to Empire, California, east of Modesto, about 5 miles, where Highway 132 crosses the Santa Fe Railroad tracks. And it's an old Church of the Brethren town founded by wheat farmers coming out from Kansas, and my grandfather was the minister in the little brick church there. God, it was a horrible place. Middle of the summer, 110 degrees, but that's all gone now. It's a real vital Mexican town now. All the old people died, moved away, but now you drive in there, it's everything's thriving, but it's all in Spanish. So that's where I left, you know, 60 years ago. I left that town and only went back to see my family. But it was a good place to grow up.
I'm a graduate of Sonora High School. So
Sonora. Uh-huh. Right? I wonder if that Tuolumne fire is getting close to Sonora.
Not quite close enough.
It's sure burning my old stomping grounds. That I spent every summer in the Sierras up on Sonora Pass at a Boy Scout camp. And then we had a church camp farther up on Sonora Pass and spent at least half the summer up there every year, as long as I can remember.
I worked for the Forest Service for two summers when I was in the university, and I was assigned Emigrant Basin. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're country boys.
That was my favorite place for many years.
You mentioned a sister. Were there other siblings?
I have a sister and a brother. They're both younger, and they both still live in the area there.
Did either of them, when they weren't being shot in the back, have interest in creating things, or were
Not
you the
thing.
Soul?
I was the sole creative person. My dad was a painter, a contractor, and my brother took over the business. My sister went to work with her husband in the fruit agricultural processing businesses over there along the railroad track. And no, nothing particularly creative in the family. I don't know where it came from.
We often don't. You mentioned being in a ceramic manufacturing.
Hans Eske was equivalent to a PhD in ceramic art and technology from the university in Munich. He was really well renowned and did a lot of ceramic murals for post offices and schools, as well as pottery. But when I was there, we were making tile for architectural murals. Way out in the country in a little place called Mittergars. The roads weren't even paved, but there was a little tiny called a shinbus, a little trolley on rails that would go out there through the villages. That was the only way to get it in town, unless you wanted to walk. And to get into Munich, I'd walk about 10 miles and start hitchhiking on the main road in Munich and spend the weekend and looking up Barbara, who had a job there at Siemens, and then I'd have to make my way back, get home late Sunday evening and have to get up early Monday morning back to work. It was kind of fun.
How did you find out about that?
Well, I was in Innsbruck, and they have this castle there in the middle of town, make available some spaces in there for local artists. And I met this guy, Arno Lehmann, who was a ceramic artist. I was just walking around touring the castle, saw him in there and went in and started talking to him. My German had gotten pretty good because I'd spent a while with an exchange student I knew good. We had a conversation. I told him I was interested in ceramic art and where would I go if, you know, I wanted to get an education. And he had all kinds of suggestions. And then finally at the end he said, but you know, I have this friend over across the border back in Germany. He has lots of work. He could hire you, you know, as an apprentice. Get back over there, get on the shinbus and go out there and knock on his door in the middle of winter with my California khakis and a corduroy jacket, snow on my shoulders. And he found it so curious, he hired me. And it turned out about every week somebody would show up knocking on the door. This guy was sending people all the time. And he thought I was an oddity, so he took me on. And it was great.
And you were there how long?
6 months before I realized that, you know, I really need proper education.
Going to college?
Well, I could see that an apprenticeship, you know, was a long road of them. So I came back, and a friend of mine from MJC had gone to San Jose State. They had the second largest art program in the state at that time and a big ceramic program. So I just went over there. Closest place for me, something I could maybe afford. I had no money from my family, no scholarships, no student loans at that time, so I had to work my way through, you know, half-time, part-time. Sometimes I had to work full-time, and then my grades suffered, but, you know, it was I could work all day and work all night and make it work.
What years are we talking about?
Oh, I went to San Jose State in 61 and left there in 67, BA, and then the MA in ceramic art. They hired me to stay on and teach for 2 years as a replacement for sabbatical leave people, so I was a bona fide associate professor with a CTA card in my pocket, and there weren't very many jobs available. I got sort of one of the last ones. Good old Chet Amix. He changed my life by choosing me. And it turned out to be a great place. At that time, it was like the end of the world for the art, for an artist. There was nothing here. And I'd been showing with my professor colleagues up there in the Bay Area, the Young, and up in Richmond and all around the Bay Area. But down here, you know, it was just a different world. It was a cow town with Aggies poking hippies with prodding sticks. But we got in on the ground floor. We were able to build a program out there, design the curriculum, design the facilities, work with local students. It was wonderful. We worked our butts off, you know. I mean, our studio classes were two units, meaning we had to teach like four classes a week. And then I'd come back in the evening and teach a couple extra evening classes and get home about midnight and have to be back out there at 7:30 in the morning. But it was great.
If we go back to the clay, mostly hand-building sculptural forms?
I got hooked on clay in a pottery class at MJC, throwing on the wheel. I thought that was really neat. Then I got exposed to the other aspects of it working in Germany. And when I came back, I decided, well, you know, ceramics is great because it has so many facets. There's the technical aspect, clay chemistry and the glaze formulas. There's the engineering of the kilns and all the pyrotechnics. There's the history. It goes back in history in ancient China and everywhere. And there's the aesthetic. It's an art form where you have to do with design. So I thought, maybe I wouldn't get bored with this. I didn't want to get locked into something that was too narrow, and ceramics certainly isn't. It's a wonderful, wonderful medium.
You are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. We return to our guest, ceramicist Barry Franz, one of the founders of the art curriculum at Cuesta College. Barry has been extolling the versatility of working with clay, but, as he explains, there is one major drawback.
But it's just so damn messy, you know. After 10 years, I was just so tired of wiping that mud off my hands. Some days I just could hardly bear going into the studio thinking, another day in the mud room, you know. So, and when it became possible to add a new wing onto the building for sculpture, I was glad to take that over and hire Guy Laemix to take over that ceramics program. So from that point on, I taught some ceramic sculpture, but mostly I was over there setting up the foundry and the metal welding and the plaster and the wood and all those other media that we taught in sculpture.
Messy enough were those too, but yeah. A little different than the clay.
Clay just, well, you can track it forever. You can never get it off your shoes.
It becomes a part of you, I think, after a while. It goes into your pores. Mm-hmm. It's
well, and certainly plaster, I think, does much the same thing.
Much
I have wonderful
same.
Imagery of the footprints at Poly going down the neat, clean hallway of the graphic designers.
Yeah. Neither of those media have I used here at home because my studio is 10 feet from the back door. And I would be in big trouble if I started tracking plaster and clay through the house.
Well, and as somebody who's carved marble, I can tell you that dust
that
tends
dust
to
too,
cling
yeah.
a lot,
mm-hmm.
too. So we'd use the air hose and do a little blow-off job every day as you'd leave, and then you get home, and then you'd sit down and go, oh.
You just
didn't
blow it
quite get
else.
It.
Yeah, grit. It's a great thing.
Who are some of the people in the medium of clay that have been inspiring to you?
Oh, I worked with Robert Arneson for a summer. He was a great inspiration.
He was at?
At Davis.
At
he
Davis, really, okay.
Yeah. He was the guy that did all those iconic self-portraits. The one of Moscone up in San Francisco.
Right. I remember the work, and I was just trying to go, was this Oakland yeah. College of Arts and Crafts, or was it no. Davis?
And we had him come down and do a workshop down here, which is wonderful. He was a real character. Somewhere there's a film of him where we plastered him with clay, a little Super 8 movie, and then as it dried, he cracked it.
Besides being dirty or being dirt, clay does have that wonderful spontaneity to it yeah, that other materials
it
can't quite match.
Definitely mud. But one of the other inspirations was Japanese ceramics. living over in the valley there, one of my inspirations was Alan Watts. He came to us on educational television from KQED, and he was illustrating Japanese calligraphy, you know, wearing this funny little kimono, and talking about Zen and, you know, Buddhism. Fascinated me. So I almost went to Japan instead of Europe. I was so interested in Oriental arts. And then when I was at San Jose the second year, my professor, Herb Sanders, who had done a sabbatical in Japan, had
Hamada?
Shoji Hamada.
Oh, yay for
you,
me.
Good for you. God, you know, we still have some communal brain cells. Yeah, he had him come up for a workshop. And I was the only one in the program at San Jose State that he invited to participate. Everyone else was from all the universities around the country. It was a real honor.
Boy.
Trouble is, it influenced me so heavily, I was making Japanese pottery. And I'd make stuff, and it'd be coming out of the kiln, and these guys would say, is this one of Shoji's? You know, well, who's made this thing, you know? I was embarrassed to say, that's mine. But I eventually had to just say, no more Japanese style. I changed consciously and directly. But still, when I sit down at the potter's wheel, instinctively I start making Japanese pots. It's just ingrained. But I had to consciously stop doing that and start using other techniques, really, even with clay. I'd do hand building and modeling and stuff that made it impossible to duplicate those things that I'd picked up from Shoji Hamada.
If you were to give a visual to Japanese ceramics, what would it be?
Well, they're beautifully simple forms, spontaneously made. There's no, you know, precision particularly. There's just an elegance, and wonderfully organic looking glazes made from natural materials and beautiful brushwork.
There was a film that we used to show. Henry Wessel showed it, and I showed it to some different classes, that was a Japanese pottery house, and of course just so steeped in tradition and watching the elders teaching the younger people how to throw. And but the most wonderful part about that film that I will never forget was they had been in production, a process called, I believe, throwing on the hump, where you have a big mound of clay, mm-hmm. you're just using the top little part of it and making a piece and cutting it off and then starting to work all over again. And they would put these bowls on these planks of wood, and then somebody would carry them out to the yard to start drying. Well, it was Japan, and it was rain season or whatever, so all of a sudden you're hearing all this commotion, and the women had been the ones mostly carrying these planks back and forth, and all of a sudden the commotion of everybody going out and grabbing a 4 or 5 foot yeah. long plank of wood that was fairly heavy because it had 5 or 6 decent sized ceramic pieces on it. And I was caught up in the Jacques Tati French films that are so visually full of puns and waiting for some slapstick kind of catastrophe to happen, as these people would be carrying these boards through this narrow hallway and turning the corner and somebody else would be coming the other direction. And it's just always left this image for me of the Japanese pottery situation, because it was just such a wonderful dance that they were doing.
It reminds me of an absurd situation I experienced, because I was doing the same thing. Because of the Japanese influence, I was putting my pieces on a 5 foot long board. You balance it on your shoulder and you walk into the next room to put them away for drying. Barbara came by to visit, and just as I was walking by, the board cracked. It fell forward and backward. And she was so embarrassed. She just turned around and walked away. And I was standing there looking stupid, you know. And everybody was looking at me thinking, wow.
Yeah, well,
I remember Hamada was asked about what happens when it rains, and he says, well, if it rains, it rains. You know, I mean, you just got to go with it. You can't fight it. You do what you can. Mm-hmm. You don't panic. You just deal with it.
After a while, then, the throwing grew into working more sculptural forms?
When I got down here, I made very little pottery. I made very little pottery ever since, you know, just when I feel like it or when I'm demonstrating and teaching, because I really like good, honest pottery. But this is the time of funk, pop, conceptualism. There were so many other ideas I wanted to explore. So some of the first things I did down here was a satirical series of figurative sculptures based on those endlessly repeated images in the art history books. And every book has the same pictures. I started treating that like pop material, like Warhol treated a soup can. It's just, it becomes dull, redundant. Why not have fun with it? So I did a series of self-portraits as art history. And there's St. Sebastian down there, that which you probably saw when we came in, and that'll be in the show. There's one of Ghirlandaio's old man with a big rosacea nose. They're all just fun, satirical things done in low-fire ceramics with the range of colors you can get with those glazes and overglazes. That was a lot of fun. I'm always reading, and I was reading Oriental philosophy more and more. So another series came out that was based on images that came to mind, reading about Hindu and Buddhist philosophy. Then I traveled. I had to teach art history, so I was reading about all these things around the world, and I got a sabbatical to go around looking at some of this stuff, and that was great. When I came back, my work changed again. For the most part, my work's always been conceptual. It's not like representational. It deals with an idea rather than, you know, trying to replicate something. But I did explore different styles and techniques that I picked up from other cultures as a way of exploring that culture and saying something about it. Giving credit to it, for one thing, and just feeding my own curiosity. Towards the end there, I became more interested in formalism. Things became more and more reductive. I started dealing with abstract forms and the relationships of forms and what that means. And I mean, all these abstract forms have archetypal kind of meaning that everyone can respond to if they just realize it. But then looking back at my earlier work where I was doing figurative thing, it all has to do with the balance of forms, you know, the juxtaposition of round forms, square forms, linear forms, open forms, closed forms, dark forms, light forms. There's this ongoing dialogue between opposites or complements in all my work, and I think that's the essence of it, whether it's figurative or completely abstract. There's this playing around with this balance. There's a Hindu concept called asana, which is often associated with these sexual figures, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just the figurative representation of this balance and complementary relationship between opposites. But it's also done with abstract forms, and it's all about balance and harmony. And I think that underlies most all my work. My graduate work that I did up at San Jose was about the balance between industrial forms and natural forms that I'd studied, lived with growing up in the country, and the forms that I saw in technology. So it's been there all along, and I just it takes different forms, different iterations, but it's all about balance.
How, for you, were you defining the term balance?
Well, I think it's unavoidable. It's something we have to cope with. We got two sides of our brain, we got two sides of our body, you know, we got males and females. Everywhere you look, there's this complementary relationship. My daughter, who has a degree in comparative religion, she says, oh, your little dualism is really simplistic. There are so many other combinations of forces out there that, you know, philosophies and religions deal with. But it's worked for me, you know, right and left. Up and down, you know, black and white. It's inevitable. I mean, we just have to walk in balance.
If you're feeling out of balance with a piece, those times when something isn't working...
Oh, you fix it with... That's what design does. Design has to deal with balance, right? All those, you know, abstract elements of design have to be brought together in harmony. And, of course, there are more than just two. But yeah, that's what design is about, making the forces work in harmony rather than antagonizing one another. Unless you want to create an antagonism, you can do it, you know?
Right.
In the end, I'm a big formalist. I think good form is what makes the difference between a weak piece and a bad piece. A person can have all the good intentions in the world and make a bad piece of art. if they don't know good design and new form. And I think that's more important than technique and craft, although that's extremely important. The best pieces have all those things going for them. But in the end, I think form is what justifies even naive pieces, you know, which are poorly made. If the form is right, it's going to work. It's going to work. Like primitive works where people really have no formal training. They can make wonderful stuff just because of an innate sense of design.
So design is helping answer those questions and problems that show up. Are there times when you just, though mentally, can't find the answer with a piece? What do you do then?
I can usually find a design solution, but sometimes the content is boring. When I retired from teaching, I thought, well, you know, I'm tired of lifting all those big, heavy ceramics and plaster investments. I'm going to take up painting. I'd had a couple classes in college, watercolors, post-toasty watercolors and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, it looks easy, you know? Technically and physically, it is easy. But it's damned hard to get something worth looking at, you know? a really viable, significant, new image. I don't want to do watercolors of landscapes, you know, seascapes, still lives. I was looking for something interesting and powerful. I never found anything that I was satisfied with, and I sort of let it go. I may go back to it someday, because smearing paint on is fun. I really admire people who can do that.
Yeah.
Because it's much more difficult than one might think. It's a two-dimensional, except for, you know, really flat, abstract stuff. It's illusion. A lot of it is illusion. Pictorial art is an illusion, and there's nothing wrong with that, except as a sculptor, I like to use the big muscles more. I like to hammer on something. I like the stuff you can get your hands on, and it's real, you know.
The show that's coming up, there are three of you that are the original faculty at Cuesta. You are the second in the trio.
Chet was the original faculty in 65 and 67. I was hired to develop the three-dimensional program. And in 72, we hired Bob Pelfrey, who was a printmaker, drawing, and he knew art history and art appreciation. And so we were the initial threesome, the three stooges that built the program with part-time people. And we've got some wonderful part-timers.
The exhibits featuring the three of you.
The three of us. David Prochaska conceived of this, but I think it's a wonderful thing. It's part of the 50th year celebration.
You have been listening to the first half of a conversation with Barry Franz, one of the three instructors that created and nurtured the arts education program at Cuesta College. Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, are being honored with shows at the Cuesta College Art Gallery to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the founding of Cuesta College. Chet Amix's show is currently running through September 20th. Barry Franz's show is September 27th through October 11th. And Bob Pelfrey's show runs October 18th through November 8th. The gallery, which is located on the Cuesta College campus, is open Monday through Friday, noon to 4 p.m. This is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX, located at 4100 Vachel Lane, just off of South Higuera, near Los Osos Valley Road, in San Luis Obispo, on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krissa Hewitt, thank you for tuning in. Tune in next week for the second half of our conversation with today's guest, ceramicist Barry Franz. And next month, we get to talk with Bob Pelfrey.